Ready to dive deep. Today, we're all about the building blocks of, well, everything. Atoms. You've been itching for a chemistry crash course, and we're cracking open chemistry, life, the universe, and everything by Melanie Cooper and Michael Pinkowski.
A fantastic choice, that one. It's got a fresh take on things.
Now, I know what you might be thinking. Atoms. Tiny things we can't even see. Why should I care? And it's a fair question. But trust me, understanding atoms is like having a backstage pass to how the whole universe works. And it all starts with this mind-blowing quote by physics legend Richard Feynman. He said, if all scientific knowledge vanished, the most information could be packed into one sentence. Ready for it. All things are made of atoms, little particles that move around in perpetual motion, attracting each other when they're a little distance apart, but repelling on being squeezed into one another.
Quite a mouthful, but he's not wrong.
Right. That one sentence packs in attraction, repulsion, constant motion, the essence of the universe. But before we get ahead of ourselves, let's rewind to where it all began.
Believe it or not, even the ancient Greeks, without fancy labs or microscopes, were trying to figure out what stuff was made of.
No way! They were thinking about atoms back then. Seriously, what they think they look like? Tiny marbles or something?
Not quite marbles, but they imagined these indivisible particles with different shapes.
Shapes? Okay, I'm intrigued.
They thought the shape determined the element's properties. For example, Earth felt solid to them, so they figured Earth atoms must be cube-shaped.
Cubes! Now that's creative.
Right. And while those early ideas were a bit off, they were onto something, an atom structure dictating its properties. It's a theme we'll see again and again as we go deeper. Plus, they're using observation and experimentation, the bedrock of science.
It's all about making those connections.
Speaking of experimentation, we can't forget alchemy, that whole quest to turn lead into gold.
Oh yeah, the alchemist's dream. They never quite cracked that code, did they?
Not quite, but they stumbled upon some legit discoveries along the way. Like isolating phosphorus.
Okay, now that's something I didn't know they did.
And get this, they found it in, wait for it, urine.
No way. Urine. Science is weird.
Tell me about it. But their, shall we say, dedicated efforts paved the way for a more systematic approach. Fast forward to the late 1700s, Antoine Lavoisier, a brilliant French chemist, meticulously identified 33 elements. That was the foundation for the periodic table we know and love.
33. And to think, we've got 91 naturally occurring elements these days, plus all the human-made ones. That's a lot of elements to keep track of. But back then, for centuries, the atom was still just a concept, right? Just an idea. How did we go from maybe these tiny things exist to actually knowing what they were made of?
Well, it was a gradual process driven by observation, experimentation, and some truly groundbreaking discoveries. And that's where John Dalton comes in, a self-taught scientist in the early 1800s who really shook things up in the atom world.
All right, Dalton, hit me with your best shot. What did he figure out?
He laid out this robust atomic theory. First, atoms were indivisible, the smallest bits possible. Second, each element had its unique type of atom. And finally, he nailed chemical reactions. No magic, just atoms rearranging themselves.
Okay, so like water is always two hydrogens and one oxygen no matter what. It all makes sense.
Exactly. Dalton's theory explained why. It boiled down to something called the law of multiple proportions. But basically, elements combine in simple whole number ratios. No half an atom allowed.
So no matter how hard I try, I can't sneak an extra half an oxygen into my water.
Nope. Dalton's theory finally gave scientists a framework to understand why elements behave the way they do. But there was still one big problem. How do you actually prove something you can't even see exists?
That's like me saying, trust me, there's a tiny invisible dragon in my pocket. You'd think I was making it up, right? So how did they finally prove, without a doubt, that atoms were real?
Picture this. It's the late 1800s, and scientists are messing around with these things called cathode ray tubes.
Oh, like those old school TVs?
Exactly. They were firing electric currents through these tubes, and it caused this glow.
Right, right. I remember those greenish glows. Kind of mesmerizing, actually.
Totally. But here's where it gets juicy. J.J. Thomson, a real whiz in physics, noticed something strange. No matter what metal they used for the tube, these rays, these beams of electricity, they acted weird. They were deflected by electric and magnetic fields, suggesting they were negatively charged.
So they knew these rays were something new, with a negative charge. But how'd they figure out it was coming from inside the atom? That's a million-dollar question.
That was Thomson's stroke of genius. He realized these negatively charged particles, which he called corpuscles, we call them electrons, now had to be coming from within the atoms themselves. There was no other explanation. Atoms weren't indivisible after all. They had parts.
Whoa. For centuries, atoms were the smallest thing, the most fundamental building block, and then bam, they find these tiny electrons inside them. Mind-blowing. So if atoms have these tiny electrons hanging out, what does that even look like? Is it like a mini solar system? Or something even weirder.
So Thomson imagined it like a plum pudding. Imagine the atom is positively charged pudding and the electrons are scattered throughout like negatively charged raisins.
Okay, that's a tastier image than I was picturing. But something tells me we're not sticking with plum pudding, are we?
You'd be right. Enter Ernest Rutherford, another big name in atomic physics. He designed this awesome experiment where he fired alpha particles, basically helium atoms without their electrons, at a super thin sheet of gold foil.
So they're shooting these alpha particles at gold foil. What were they expecting to happen? Were they expecting the particles to just fly right through?
Well, if Thomson's plum pudding model was right, those alpha particles should have zipped right through the gold with maybe a tiny deflection, if anything. The positive charge in the plum pudding was spread out, you see.
So I'm guessing they were in for a surprise.
Oh, yeah. Big time. Most of the alpha particles went straight through, but a tiny fraction, like 1 in 8,000, bounced back, as if they'd hit something incredibly small and dense right in the atom's core. Rutherford said it best. It was almost as incredible as if you fired a 15-inch shell at a piece of tissue paper and it came back and hit you.
Ouch. That's one way to put it. So what did this unexpected bounce back tell them? What was going on in there?
It meant Thomson's plum pudding was toast. The fact that some alpha particles bounced straight back meant there had to be a tiny, super dense, positively charged nucleus in the atom center, with the electrons orbiting around it, way out there. The planetary model of the atom was born.
Okay, now we're getting closer to those atom diagrams from high school. But if the nucleus is so tiny and the electrons are orbiting far away, What's in all that empty space in between? Is it really just empty?
You've hit the nail on the head. The atom is mostly empty space. It's mind-boggling. Later, experiments showed that the nucleus, while incredibly dense, is tiny compared to the whole atom. And within that tiny nucleus, scientists found the proton with a positive charge and the neutron with no charge.
Protons, neutrons, electrons, got it.
And here's the thing, protons and neutrons are much heavier than electrons. They're what give the nucleus its mass.
It's amazing. We're mostly made up of empty space. It's hard to believe anything can feel solid with all that emptiness.
It's all down to the forces at work within and between atoms. They're the key.
Okay, spill the beans. What forces are keeping everything from flying apart or collapsing into a super dense dot? What's the secret sauce?
All right, so there are four fundamental forces controlling the universe, and they all come into play within an atom. Gravity, the electromagnetic force, and the strong and weak nuclear forces. Quite a lineup.
Four forces, wow. I've at least heard of gravity. That's what keeps my feet on the ground, right?
You got it. But in the world of atoms, gravity's actually super weak. It's nothing compared to the electromagnetic force, which dictates how charged particles interact. Think static cling, magnets, even the feeling of solidity when you touch something.
Wait, so when I push on a wall and my hand doesn't go through it, it's not because the atoms are actually touching, but because their electromagnetic forces are pushing back.
Bingo. Now, these strong and weak nuclear forces, their main gig is inside the nucleus itself. Mm. The strong force is strong, like its name says. It's what holds those positively charged protons together in the nucleus. Without it, the atom would fly apart. And the weak nuclear force, that one's all about radioactive decay. Super interesting, but not our focus today.
Got it. Nuclear forces keeping things tight in the nucleus makes sense. But what about those electrons zipping around in all that empty space? How do they interact with each other and the positively charged nucleus?
I know that's a great question. It all boils down to the electromagnetic force again. Opposite charges attract, like charges repel, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the negatively charged electrons are naturally drawn to the positively charged nucleus. But There's a catch. There's always a catch.
I had a feeling there'd be a catch. Atoms are tricky like that. What's the catch this time? You know, I got to hear about this catch. Lay it on me. What's the patch with electrons?
Well, electrons, they never sit still. They're constantly moving, buzzing around the nucleus like, well, a swarm of bees.
Okay, I like where you're going with this. So it's not so much a mini solar system with planets in neat little orbits. It's more like a chaotic beehive.
That's a great way to put it. You can't really pinpoint the exact location of each bee. You see the overall swarm, right? Same with electrons. That's where the ideal electron clouds comes in. Instead of tiny points whizzing around, picture a fuzzy cloud of negative charge hanging around the nucleus.
A fuzzy cloud. Okay, I think I can visualize that.
The denser the cloud, the more likely you are to find an electron there.
So it's less about fixed orbits and more about probability. Like, the negative charge is smeared out, creating a kind of force field around the nucleus. Am I getting that right?
You got it. And it's this constant motion of charge, these electron clouds always shifting and fluctuating, that gives us those London dispersion forces, or LDFs we talked about. Remember those?
Right, LDFs. Those temporary attractions between atoms. How did those work again? Remind me.
So at any given moment, the electron cloud around an atom can fluctuate, creating what we call temporary dipoles.
Yeah.
Basically, one side might become a bit more negative, while the other side gets a bit more positive.
A temporary imbalance in the force field.
Exactly. And when another atom gets close, its electron cloud sees this temporary dipole and gets influenced. It creates an opposite dipole in itself. And what happens when you have opposite charges?
They attract. Ah, so it's this constant, subtle dance of attraction and repulsion, all thanks to these flickering dipoles. It makes sense, but if everything's always attracting and repelling, why doesn't the entire universe just clump together into one giant blob?
Now, you're asking the big questions. And honestly, that's what makes chemistry so fascinating. It all boils down to the strength of those attractions. Some are stronger, some are weaker. It's all relative.
Okay, I'm following you. So some attractions are stronger than others. Tell me more about this.
Let's take helium. Helium atoms, they've got very weak LDFs. They're content to be on their own. It takes very little energy to overcome those weak attractions, which is why helium at room temperature is a gas.
So helium atoms are like the ultimate introverts of the atomic world. They're just not interested in sticking together.
Exactly. Now compare that to hydrogen. When two hydrogen atoms get close, they can form a bond, and it's a strong one. They share their electrons in a way that lowers their overall energy. This is a covalent bond, and it's what forms the stable hydrogen molecule H2.
So it's like the difference between a quick hello on the street and a long, deep friendship. Helium atoms have those weak LDFs, those fleeting interactions. But hydrogen atoms, they go all in with a strong covalent bond, a real power couple.
Love that analogy. But here's the really cool part. Even though those hydrogen atoms are bound together tight in their H2 molecule, those H2 molecules can still interact with each other. It's those LDFs again, those temporary dipoles.
Wait, so even though they're already in a committed relationship, they can still be a little bit flirty with other molecules?
Exactly. But these intermolecular LDFs are much weaker than that initial covalent bond that brought the H2 together, so it takes less energy to break them apart. That's why hydrogen, like helium, is a gas at room temperature.
It's amazing. These tiny fluctuations in the electron cloud, these temporary dipoles, they're shaking so much of how matter behaves. Whether something's a gas, a liquid, or a solid, it all comes down to these tiny interactions at the atomic level. And to think, we started all the way back with the ancient Greeks and their cube-shaped atoms.
We've come a long way. And the best part, we've only scratched the surface of the atom's mysteries. There's so much more to uncover.
I'm already hooked. To all our listeners, if you're as wowed by this tiny world of atoms as I am, don't stop exploring. There's a whole universe of knowledge out there, waiting to be discovered, one atom at a time. Catch you in the next deep dive. Happy learning.